Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting through our studios in New York City and all over the world. And I welcome you to this program. We have a lot to share from an important new study on vitamin K as an ideal therapy for cancer. University of California, Berkeley, children should eat organic to reduce pesticide levels. Tart cherries are reducing muscle soreness and speed recovery in post-workout, Texas A&M University. Menopausal women urged to eat soy, of course that's organic non-GMO soy, University of Hull in the United Kingdom. Dark chocolate can boost the time of your performance if you're a cyclist. A lot of people are. Kensington University, also in the United Kingdom, and more. Then what if Jesus had been born today in the new American police state? John W. Whitehead, Countercurrents. Does fear lead to fascism, a culture of fear, and the epigenetics of terror? I think you'll find that of importance. And also, want to take a look today at several of the issues that we don't talk about in our society. For example, are we a state that accepts the value of all life, or just those who are powerful, important, successful? What does it say about us? Pharmaceuticals in our water supply. When you turn on your tap, it may look clear and clean, maybe, but also could have hundreds of different parts per billion, but still active in your body, still destructive, of drugs, chemotherapy drugs, AIDS drugs, statins, tranquilizers. Yeah, they're getting into our water supply. And what is the role of empathy? What is the best way to ease one's pain and suffering? Is it to blame others? How often in our society, when something goes wrong, the very first thing we do is we immediately blame someone? Why do we have this fetish for blame? And more often than not, the person who is doing the blaming is the person who caused the problem, but not wanting to own their responsibility, so they ratchet it up. And they get to a point where they're simply rageful. And how often do we experience that in our lives? And if so, why do we tolerate it? So we're going to take a look at some of these issues today. Also, we're going to look at some things that generally don't get any attention. For example, China's just launching what could be the most frightening game ever, and it's soon going to be mandatory. Will it also come to other countries, including the United States? From Claire Barnish from Anti-Media. Wait to hear what the Chinese are doing to every citizen. You talk about Orwell's dystopian state of mind, they're actualizing it. And think of the title, Sesame Credit. Sesame Credit, that sounds like Sesame Street, something for kids, something nice, fun, educational. No, it is not. The owners of China's largest social network have partnered with the government to create something akin to the U.S. credit score, but instead of measuring how regularly you pay your bills, it measures how obediently you follow the party line. And you're expected to tell on other people, and you're expected to grade other people. Gee, wonder how that'll turn out. We'll discuss that. Also, some declassified Cold War files. You know how we hear people in the military who never state how much money they're making when they're appearing as a so-called intelligence or security expert, but they're all affiliated with think tanks and the military contractors. They tell us that there's a humane way to deal with nuclear, hence it justifies spending $1 trillion on new nuclear, as if we don't have enough to kill every person in the world 27,000 times, which is an accurate fact. Well, the Strategic Air Command Atomic Weapons Requirement Study for 1959 was broken down into two lists. One was air power, referring to airfields and other military sites. but the other was systemic destruction. Meaning, the United States military and the presidents of the United States, each one under this, were targeting urban areas and population targets. 1,200 cities in total from East Germany to China. So they meant to have a big kill-off of human beings, just citizens. What kind of mind would think it's acceptable to kill a billion people? And that's the people who were running our Cold War, the military-industrial complex, and that's exactly who's running it today. You think it's any different today? Absolutely identical. Sociopaths. Also, I think it's important that we took another look at what's going on that the media does not discuss. Yemen. Yemen is our war. We're supplying the intelligence, we're supplying the refueling of planes, we're supplying the weapons, the bombs, and we have people on the ground, CIA operatives. But it's Saudi's war. Saudi's our ally. What is the cost of that to the people living in Yemen? How bad is it? Well, let's put it this way. It's terrible, and almost all of it is an act of crime against humanity. Media Benjamin to discuss that. And also, hey, for all the good Democrats out there, and we know we got a lot of them listening, who are going to vote for Hillary because they want to see a good Democrat in office, here's what she just said. Quote, if elected president, I'll shut down 50,000 public schools. Quote, I wouldn't keep any school open that wasn't doing a better than average job, end quote. 50,000 schools. Let's see. And she said that in Iowa, and Iowa has 500,000 students enrolled in public K-12 schools. Okay. And according to the U.S. Department of Education, there are just over 98,000 public schools in the United States, so Hillary Clinton's going to turn the lights off in one half of all public schools? Great idea. Oh, unless you're a student or parent of a student or a teacher in one of those schools, where are they supposed to go to school then? I see. A charter school, one of those places that pay you $250,000 to come and give a lecture. I'll go into that. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. We always begin this program on with health and nutrition information. Today, it's about dark chocolate. A good study out of the Kingston University, which is in the United Kingdom, found that the flavanol-rich dark chocolate can boost endurance and exercise performance in trained male cyclists. Now, they're talking about 40 grams. Well, you got 28.35 grams to an ounce, so you're talking about a small amount. Just under 2 ounces. That's a small, that's an, two little tiny squares. That's what that represents. What fit into a tablespoon, level tablespoon. This was published in the Journal of International Society of Sports Nutrition. Quote, the primary outcome observed was dark chocolate consumption increased the work rate achieved by 11% compared to the control. So that's a and 21% compared to no chocolate. The other was white chocolate. So you mean you could get 21% greater endurance and in cardiorespiratory fitness by eating 2 pieces of chocolate? Wow. Well, then why not eat that chocolate and go for a power walk? Or go swimming? It would help, so that's really good. There's a lot of benefits, of course. We know that the flavin-3-ols, or catechins, that are in the cacao, are beneficial to our heart. And particularly the what is called the monomeric flavanol, epicatechin, and it's extremely beneficial. So study after study There are now over 100 studies showing the benefits of chocolate. Coconut oil. This is a good study, especially for all the people in this audience who have a family member suffering from some form of brain condition. It might be Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, multiple sclerosis. Coconut oil improves cognitive functioning in Alzheimer's patients. Now, of course, if it improves it in Alzheimer's patients, there's no reason to believe it wouldn't help a person with dementia. Same phenomena occurring. So I would suggest, and based upon this study, which was a good study, I would suggest that you have 1 teaspoon of raw organic coconut oil twice a day. That comes to about 3 tablespoons. So a tablespoon and a half in the morning, tablespoon and a half in the evening. That's what they use in this group. And they had some remarkable benefits. So let's get some coconut oil in there. It turns off inflammation in the brain. And the drugs are total, complete failure. And millions of senior citizens are using them. Now we can use something inexpensive. This is from the University of Hull in the United Kingdom. This was published in the Society of Endocrinology's report. They're suggesting that soy, which can help a lot of different conditions, can combat bone loss and can protect against osteoporosis in women over 50. Now, as women get older and go through menopause, they experience a drop in the level of the hormone estrogen, which protects against bone loss. Now, this can make them particularly susceptible to osteoporosis, which leads to millions of fractures annually. And a research team from the University of Hull in the United Kingdom has concluded that a diet rich in soy protein and isoflavones, those are the plant substances which act in a similar way in the body to estrogen, provides protection from bone weakening during menopause. They used 200 women in this study over 6 months, and they were either given a supplement which contained 66 milligrams of isoflavones, I recommend 200 milligrams, or one containing just soy protein, which would act as a placebo. And there was a big difference when they got the soy isoflavones. So make sure you're getting your isoflavone. It will help you with osteoporosis. It helps with other things, too, including hot flashes. Another thing that helps when you are sore and your muscles are aching, tart cherry. According to Texas A&M University, by using tart cherries, about 480 milligrams a day, that's a very small amount. This is the Montmorency tart cherry skin powder. For 10 days, they decrease the markers of muscle catabolism in resistance training individuals. Quote, the current study demonstrated the consumption of the Montmorency powdered tart cherry 7 days before and day of and 2 days after completing a single bout of high-volume, high-intensity resistance exercise appears to be an effective dietary supplement in reducing muscle soreness across the most biomechanically loaded region of the quadriceps near the distal patellar attachment and markers of muscle catabolism in resistance training individuals. This was published in the Journal of the Journal of International Society of Sports and Nutrition. In lay language, if you're an athlete, no matter what the sport, and if your muscles ache, by taking in what amounts to a teaspoon of tart cherry, I would suggest a tart cherry concentrate would be fine. It's helping protect you from oxidative stress. It is providing a ability to recover quicker and reduce muscle soreness. But why not look at what it would do for a person who's not exercised but still has the same problem? There's no reason if it's an antioxidant and if it's turning off inflammation, it wouldn't turn off inflammation in a person with bursitis, fibromyalgia, arthritis, sore back, gout. It does. University of California, Berkeley. A new study shows that children should eat organic. Why? To reduce their pesticide levels. For a long time, anyone familiar with the health movement, especially anyone buying organic, would know that organophosphorus, or what's called OP pesticides, like dazinion, are bad for humans as well as pests. Almost two decades ago, they began to be phased out for residential use due to the risks. Unfortunately, they're still heavily used in agriculture. And researchers in California decided to identify how much of these and other harmful pesticides children actually ingest. This study focused upon low-income children in urban and agriculture areas. And if it feels like you've already heard this information, you probably have, but not quite in this way. Previous studies have focused on pesticide levels in children in non-agriculture and suburban areas. As most of us know, these studies have shown that children have lower levels of pesticides when they go organic. And the difference with this new study is that children in urban areas and agriculture areas are exposed to more pesticides in the environment, especially those in low-income families. Therefore, the question was not whether organic diets reduce pesticide levels. We know they do. But whether children who are exposed to environmental pesticides have reduced levels when they go organic as well. For this reason, the study included participants in the area around Oakland, California, an urban area, and also in Salinas, California, largely an agriculture area. And they found that, yes, the amount of two pesticides reduced by 50% on an all-organic diet. That's important. So what's the takeaway message of this? Here it is. Pesticides can stay in the body a long period of time. They disrupt enzyme systems. They are extremely toxic to the body because the body can't use them. But also, it's dangerous to store them because even when they're in the fat tissue being stored, they're harmful. And that's why when any time I detoxify someone, I do it in a gradual way. Not all at once. You have to stage a detox over about a six-month period. So every day you're adding something that allows the pesticides or heavy metals, lead, cadmium, mercury, to be grabbed onto, what we call chelate, and taken out of the body, principally through the urine. And to do it correctly, you're doing it, I would say, 6 months to a year. It generally takes a year to 2 years to fully detoxify, but you can do it. And what do you see happening when you're fully detoxified? Your energy comes back. Tremendous amount of energy. You wake up in the morning, you feel vital, not sluggish. You don't feel sleepy at night. You frequently have to force yourself to go to bed because you're not tired. You also find that you're clear in your thinking because your brain is working. Your mitochondria is working. Pesticides interfere with mitochondrial function, the energy factories. You also have better digestion, and better absorption because you don't have the pesticides interfering in the process. So when you detoxify, everything works better, and you lose weight, and your pulse rate comes down because you're exercising, and that's good. It lengthens the lifespan of the heart. So by eating organic, and you can get organic at the local farmer's market, small health food stores, and food co-ops, or grow it yourself. So that's what I would suggest. Something new to be used in fighting cancer, from Ben Gurion International, there was a discussion on vitamin K, and it looks like vitamin K is one more of the factors that can help with people with all forms of cancer and actually speeds up programmed cell death, which is a key process regulating cancer development and progression. Therapies that cause programmed cell death of cancer cells are critical. They're important. And vitamins play an essential role in cellular reactions and maintaining human health. And there's a growing realization that a lack of micronutrients can create an environment where cancer can begin. So Vitamin K exists in two natural forms. There's also the man-made form, and the two natural forms of vitamin K are fat-soluble and are usually chemically readily easily gotten, and there's no toxicity there. And one is from green leafy vegetables, that's K1, some vegetable oils, like soybean oil, and K2. Now, K2 is extracted from animal products, and K1 has been found to play a big role in various types of cancer. So when you're eating your vegetables, your dark green leafy vegetables, and you're drinking the juice of those, you're providing K1 to the body, and that will help you with different cancers, including pancreatic cancer. And finally, what we found is nitrate-rich beet juice shows benefits for high cholesterol levels. This is from Queen Mary University in London. And it says, and this is published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, quote, daily intake of beet juice may improve vascular function in people with elevated cholesterol levels. 6 weeks of daily consumption of a nitrate-rich beet juice produced significant increases in flow-mediated dilation, a measure of blood flow and vascular health. This was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study. Quote, in this 6-week trial of daily nitrate beet juice ingestion compared with intake of a low-nitrate placebo in patients with a hypercholesterolemia, a rise in circulating nitrate was associated with an approximately 24% improvement in primary outcome measurement of the FMD response together with improvement in measures of arterial stiffness. So what that means is that the arteries are going to be more pliable and that you're going to bring down your cholesterol level. So you get a double positive just from having beet juice. Nobody ever used to buy beet juice. You go in a health food store, you never see it. Now, it's very popular. So I definitely recommend beet juice if you have elevated cholesterol. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. We have a lot to share with you, and in just a second we're going to go to a clip that I think you'll find of interest. And please keep in mind that that if for any reason the program you're hearing should drop out, our sister stations all have a backup program that I did yesterday that no one's heard. They can play so that you won't be lost for a show. There's some individuals who are tearing down our site. We're rebuilding it, and we're getting to the bottom of it. And so hopefully we'll get ahead of this. But if you don't hear us, that's what's happening. It's happening 4 or 5 times, and we just keep bringing in smarter people to make our site more challenging for those who oppose what I have to say. And there are a lot of those out there. Just look at the FDA and the CDC, National Institutes of Health. Look at all the different industries, the GMO industry. Look at the pro-drugs for AIDS industry and its activist groups. There's no shortages of people who share a difference of opinion, which is their right. I don't have a problem with that. But when any individual or any group decides that they want to prevent freedom of speech, that's not acceptable. But whatever they do today, we'll keep speaking, writing on what we're challenging them. So I just want to share that with you. And also, a lot of people are listening over listening devices right now all over the world. And that's really cool, especially younger people. They have all these different devices, and they just want to keep in touch. And each day, Eastern time at noon, other stations will play the program, take it down, play it in their own time. They can listen over any portable device. Here's the number you call in to listen live. 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. And we were just informed yesterday that we are at 20 million minutes listened to. Number one in North America and Canada. Of all the thousands and thousands of radio stations and others that use this, we're number one. That's how many people are listening. And I also am putting up a lot of hard-hitting articles. Two articles you should be reading on vaccines. Are they efficacious? Are they safe? Go up on our website, download them, read them, and share them with other people. I'm on the road doing some documentaries, hard-hitting documentaries, and if some people are angry, now they're going to really be angry when they see what I have on tape. You see, I work very quietly. I have the evidence, all the evidence. And one whole documentary was completely shot, the entire documentary, with a secret camera. And wait till you see it. It's just going to blow your mind. So we have some hard-hitting things coming. And by the way, for all of you who've been passing on Poverty Inc. to your friends to watch, thank you. It's right now, I was told, has won the most awards of any documentary in the United States this year. And we put a trailer up showing all those awards and people's comments as they come out of the theaters after seeing it. And it's up on the website. You can see that trailer for yourself. That's the war on Poverty Inc. Now let's listen to a clip, and I'll give some comments on it afterwards.
No word strikes more fear into the heart of Fox News anchors. No four syllables shakes the 1% more to its core than socialism.
The problem with socialism is,
why would President Obama want America to be more socialist than capitalist?
43% of 18 to 29-year-olds think socialism is okay.
Socialism is a dirty word in American politics. It's lobbed at presidents to try and tear them down and used by outsiders to set them apart. But what is it? Socialism is a political and economic theory of social organization that advocates the means of production, distribution, and exchange should be owned or regulated by the community as a whole. There are many different types of socialists, but the main idea is that the rich and the powerful don't get to call all the shots when it comes to the economy. But here's the thing that no one will tell you. America is already socialist. Here's why. Americans work like socialists. You know those 2 days a week where your boss can't berate you? What are they called? The weekend. The weekend was never part of big business's plan. It was fought for and won by the labor movement of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a labor movement that was full of socialists. In 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act. It established a 40-hour work week, minimum wage, and eliminated child labor, which is a good thing, unless you run a sweatshop. Some of the most remarkable Americans, maybe even some of your heroes, were socialists. Mark Twain, Ernest Hemingway, Jack London, Cesar Chavez, Helen Keller, even Harry Houdini was a socialist. Now America has Bernie Sanders, who calls himself a democratic socialist, and Danny Glover, who's so down. But I'm still waiting on Lethal Weapon 5, the picket line. Whenever you get on a highway, drive over a bridge, use electricity from a dam, or go to a school or hospital, you're probably partaking in American socialism. To pull the country out of the Great Depression, over 30,000 public works programs were sponsored by the government under Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. Infrastructure that's now crumbling, even with President Obama's 2009 economic stimulus package, which tried to pull us out of the most recent Wall Street-induced financial meltdown. But the New Deal wasn't labeled socialism, except by its critics. FDR defended it, saying, "The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, it is whether we provide enough for those who have little." The New Deal also included unemployment insurance and Social Security, making sure that you can get back on your feet when you lose your job and you're taken care of when you get old and crotchety. You could call it big government socialism or just looking out for one another. The military, the one area of spending no one would dare call socialist. And yet, it's largely funded by you, the taxpayer. Strange, for all the wars the U.S. has fought trying to stop the spread of socialist ideas, you'd think that war was a capitalist venture.
Around 27% of your tax dollar goes to fund the biggest and most expensive military in the world, with a budget of $598.5 billion. Compare that to spending on unemployment, social security, education, science, and infrastructure, and it looks like the military is red all over. Good God, y'all. Welfare is also one of those things that's bad-mouthed for being socialist, because why take care of the needy? But what about corporate welfare? Since 2000, Uncle Sam has given $68 billion in business grants and tax credits, two-thirds of which has gone to large corporations. Transportation and energy are the biggest beneficiaries. Even some of the biggest corporations, like Walmart, encourage their employees to use food stamps and other government services because apparently the most profitable corporation in the world can't pay a livable wage. It's almost like socialism is fine if it helps the rich, but terrible if it helps everyone else. In the end of the day, socialism is as American as apple pie, bought at a Walmart with food stamps.
Just a few thoughts. It was John F. Kennedy who said, "Too often we enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought." If we're nothing more or less, we are programmed to believe things without that discomfort of finding our beliefs true or not. Here we have all these people over at Fox railing against socialism, but it's always in the context of who the socialism would benefit. If it's for the poor, then they attack it. We don't want that. However, look at the reality of socialism today. Bernie Sanders is not a true socialist. They wouldn't be in the same room with him because he's a warmonger and supports Saudi Arabia, which by supporting it and encouraging it to have even more power, you must then ask yourself with true thought, what are they about to do with this power? Well, let's look at Yemen. We wouldn't be in Yemen, and we are, fighting to destroy the people who want their freedom if it weren't for Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is the most corrupt and ruthless and dangerous state on the planet. They do more to sponsor, control, and unleash legions of terrorists than any place else in the world. And yet we choose not to talk about that, what they do to their own citizens, beheadings and lashings and beating people or beheading people. We don't talk about it. If you were a true person, a true socialist nature, you're against all war. There is no such thing as the good war. Obama said Afghanistan was a good war. Why don't you go to Afghanistan and go to the villages and look at what the war that we called a good war has done to the people who are not our enemies, but are victims of it. Also, when socialism benefits big oil with the tax allowances, when it benefits companies who can make profit in America but pay no taxes and then get subsidies, that's socialism for the very rich. So how many of the major corporations actually pay taxes? How about none? Almost zero. But they're supposed to. Yes, they're supposed to, but they also have the lobbyists that control the laws. And as such, they write the laws that allow them to keep more of the profits. Would they be hurt by paying a fair share taxes if they all had to pay, let's say, a flat tax of 15%? Would that hurt them? The answer is no, not at all. Would it help? It would help the United States. It would help bring in that revenue that we don't have. Big Agra, they're supported by enormous social programs we the people pay for. Does Big Agra care about us? They give us genetically engineered food. They give us irradiated food that somehow Mother Jones thought was a good idea, but we see where Mother Jones has gone. Then we look at the banking system. What would have happened if we would have nationalized the banks when they were in trouble, took them all over, all the big banks, the ones that were failing, and then made them go under a model similar to the Bank of North Dakota, the most well-run bank in America? We would not have bank bailouts. What if we no longer subsidized through social projects the tech industry, the military industry, the medical industry, we would be living in a very different world where we wouldn't have this great divide between have and have-nots. That's one of the big differences, and yet we don't think about that. I once heard someone say on a talk show, I was riding in a cab, and I got out before I could hear who the host was, but the argument went like this. We don't need socialism. We need the private marketplace to control everything. Well, the private marketplace already controls everything and has. So what are the consequences? Everything we're dealing with now is a consequence. Bubbles everywhere and collapsing of those bubbles and devastation and 96 million Americans who could work who are not working. And yet we don't consider them unemployed. They're just wiped off the map. They're no longer a part of any thought. You have 56 million people living in rural America. They're mainly poor. They're struggling. What do you think of the consequences of 56 million people when their children don't have enough food and they're losing everything they have? What do you think happens when people lose it all? Then they lose it. But we haven't seen it yet. We will in time. So we don't count 96 million people who are unemployed as important. They're out of the equation. We don't consider all these people living in rural America important, so they're out of the equation. And we don't consider 18 million hungry children important. We don't consider 20 million sick senior citizens important. So we've excluded a lot of people that we're going to care about. And the difference is that if we had people power over commodities essential life, water, oil, gas, food, then they could not create the marketplace that yields poverty and pain. Something to think about. Now, something else to think about at this time of year is people run out there and do all this shopping to buy a gift. Why? What if the gift was a gift of spending quality time with someone, going out to dinner with someone, sharing time without a cell phone to interrupt you, just you and your friend or friends or family? Why not do something that's a gift of your heart, of your own mind, instead of buying something and feeling guilty if you don't? It was Reza Aslan, who's going to be a guest, he's a religious scholar, next week on this program, who said, 2,000 years later, the memory of the revolutionary zealot who walked across Galilee gathering an army of disciples with the goal of establishing the kingdom of God on earth, the magnetic preacher who defied the authority of the temple priesthood in Jerusalem, the radical Jewish nationalist who challenged the Roman occupation and lost, has been completely lost to history. End quote. But not to John Whitehead. You see, the Christmas narrative of a baby born in a manger is a familiar one. The Roman Empire, a police state in its own right, had ordered that a census be conducted, and Joseph and his pregnant wife Mary traveled to the little-known Bethlehem community so that they could be counted. Jesus would grow up to undermine the political and religious establishment of his day and was eventually crucified as a warning to others not to challenge the powers that be. But what if the revered preacher, teacher, radical prophet had been born 2,000 years later? How would Jesus' life have been different had he been born and raised in the American police state? Rather than traveling to Bethlehem for a census, Jesus' parents would have been mailed a 28-page American Community Survey, a mandatory government questionnaire documenting their habits, household inhabitants, work schedule, and even how many toilets they have in their home. Instead of being born in a manger, Jesus might have been born at home. Rather than wise men and a shepherds bringing gifts, the baby's parents might have been forced to ward off visits from state social workers intent on prosecuting them for the home birth, even though a study yesterday showed that home births do not endanger the newborn child or the mother. Had Jesus been born in a hospital, his blood and DNA would have been taken and entered into a government biobank without his parents' knowledge or consent. Then again, had his parents been undocumented immigrants, they and the newborn baby might have been shuffled to a profit-driven private detention center for illegals. Once in school, Jesus would have been drilled in lessons of compliance and obedience to government authorities, all the while learning little about his own rights. And if he dared to challenge school officials, he might have found himself suspended under a zero-tolerance policy that punishes minor infractions, such as doodling or talking in class. And those are judged today as harshly as serious offenses like bringing a weapon to class. According to Scripture, Jesus, at the age of 12, wandered the temple courts in Jerusalem alone and unsupervised. Today, had Jesus disappeared for just an hour, let alone days, his parents would have been handcuffed, arrested, and jailed for parental negligence. Rather than disappearing from the history books from his early teenage years to adulthood, Jesus' movements and personal data, including his biometrics, would have been documented, tracked, monitored, and filed by government agencies and corporations such as Google and Microsoft, all headed by very unusual people. If Jesus were to ever make contact with the likes of John the Baptist, he would have been flagged for government surveillance because of his association with a prominent activist. Peaceful or otherwise is irrelevant. All activity that challenges corporate interest or the government makes you a domestic terrorist. Rather than being permitted to live as an itinerant preacher, Jesus might have found himself threatened with arrest for daring to collect his own rainwater, or to live off the grid, or sleeping in an RV. Had his travels taken him from community to community, Jesus might have been reported to government officials as suspicious under the Department of Homeland Security's See Something, Say Something programs. Perceived as a dissident and a potential threat to the government's powers, Jesus might have had government spies planted among his followers in order to monitor his activities, report on his movements, and entrap him into breaking the law. Oh, did I forget to say that 98% of all those potential terror attacks that were thwarted by our government were all setups? They were all people who weren't going to do anything until they were encouraged to do and given the tools to do it and then arrested for attempting it. Jesus' anti-government views would have certainly have resulted in him being labeled a domestic extremist. Law enforcement agencies are being trained to recognize signs of anti-government extremism during interactions with potential extremists who share belief in the approaching collapse of government or the economy. Assuming Jesus used the internet to spread his radical message of peace and love, he might have found his blog post infiltrated by government spies attempting to undermine his integrity, discredit him, or plan incriminating information online about him, like Wikipedia. At the very least, he would have had his website hacked and his email monitored. Had Jesus attempted to feed large crowds of people, he would have been threatened with arrest for violating various ordinances prohibiting the distribution of food without permit. And he could have met in jail a lot of other people, including people from different churches who have been threatened with jail or arrested for feeding the poor. After all, there's nothing that quite says hypocrisy like a group of white Christians who then are threatened by people who act Christian, like feeding the poor. Maybe I missed it, however. Maybe there was a giant protest by the Episcopalians, the Baptists, the Lutherans, the Methodists, the Catholics. Surely there was a huge outpouring of thousands of people when there was a church group in one southern state that was threatened with arrest if they continued to feed the homeless. Did that happen? Oh, yeah, but the protest didn't. Had Jesus spoken publicly about his 40 days in the desert and his conversation with the devil, he would have definitely been labeled mentally ill, detained in a psych ward against his will for mandatory involuntary psychiatric hold with no access to family or friends, and probably given psychiatric drugs and put in four-point restraints when he tried to pray. Without a doubt, had Jesus' attempt to overturn tables in a Jewish temple and raged against the materialism of religious institutions, he would have been charged with a hate crime. Currently, 45 states and the federal government have hate crime laws on the books. And rather than having armed guards capture Jesus in a public place, government officials would have ordered a SWAT team. Of course, they have to take their steroids first, about 3,000 pounds of steroids before a raid, pumps them up, makes them feel good. And then they would have raided Jesus and his followers, complete with flashbang grenades, military equipment. They love it. And there are upwards of 80,000 such SWAT team raids carried out every year in the United States on unsuspecting Americans who have no defense against such government invaders, even when such raids are done in error or to serve a summons for an outstanding bill that hasn't been paid. Maybe there was a giant demonstration against this. No. Well, surely, if Jesus were around today, he would have seen demonstrations against 30 million Americans who've been thrown out of their homes. No, there were no protests. But how about our invasion of Libya and the destruction? No. How about the $1.5 trillion military-industrial complex budget? No, not that either. How about the fact that American medicine's number one cause of death and there's no reform? No, don't talk about doctors or pills. That's sacred. That should be a Bible to itself. They certainly, we pray at an altar of medicine. They're in. No, no protest. How about just the buying of elections? How about the corruption of all of our state legislatures with Alex? No. How about the bailout of these sociopath, psychopath, completely degenerate bank runners from Morgan Stanley? These are all terrible human beings. No, we haven't protested that either. How about the bias of the media, including alternative media, including Pacifica media, and censorship? Oh, no, the left never protests itself. I see. How about the sociopaths on Fox, the fascist network? No, you're not allowed to do that. Surely someone protested the 18 million hungry children. No. No, we're not big at these things. But we're certain that if it ever occurs to us, we will become concerned. I see. So what would Jesus say today when he took a look at we celebrating him? But if he were born today, well, instead of being detained by Roman guards, Jesus might have been made to disappear into a secret government detention center, such as Homan Square in Chicago, and with a clown character mayor like Rahm Emanuel, where he would have been interrogated, tortured, and subject to all manner of abuses, charged with treason and labeled a domestic terrorist by the President of the United States and all the people who sit around him. Just imagine about 4,000 people, military-industrial complex, Pentagon, Joint Chiefs of Staff, they've got to look at where their next job is, Halliburton, and then all the people associated with the police state, then all associated with the Justice Department and the FBI and Homeland Security. Then now you got over 2 million people. It spreads and spreads. And how many of those are interested in actually seeing as someone innocent without torturing them or assuming they are? None. Do we protest it? Not at all. But we may, if it were us. I see. So if Jesus were alive today or born today, there's almost 100% certainty that he would either be A, killed, that's a certainty. He would be imprisoned in a private prison for life and forced to provide slave labor for corporations, maybe growing tilapia for Whole Foods. That's a good thing. All right? Because then he could have a lot of fish, though he wouldn't have a lot of people to serve it to. Or maybe he would be given a choice. Electric chair, lethal mixture of drugs, or, you know, we'll just beat you to death. Now, surely there'd be some Christians in America who would protest. No, there wouldn't be. That's the irony of Christmas. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Snap your finger, I'll come running back to you on bended knee. Snap your finger, I'll come running. I'll be true. Take a chance on me. Let your light turn green. Maybe I've got to know.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. Will I be broadcasting tomorrow? You bet. Every day. Celebrating a holiday is only important if you understand the deeper spiritual meaning of that and celebrate it at that level, not the commercial level, which means that there is no meaning at all. Now let's listen to another audio clip here. This is about pharmaceuticals in our drinking water.
Well, do you know what's in your drinking water? A shocking Associated Press investigation found various pharmaceuticals in the drinking supplies of at least 41 million Americans. Tainted water was found from New Jersey to California. NBC's Tom Costello is following the story from Washington. Tom, I've been dying to ask somebody some questions about this story. First of all, what kinds of drugs are we talking about, and how dangerous is this?
Pretty wide range. Here's the drinking water in Washington, D.C. They found six pharmaceuticals in our drinking water here. They include ibuprofen, caffeine, monacin, and about three or four others. In Philadelphia, they had 56 pharmaceuticals or byproducts. They range everything from epilepsy medication to mental health medicines to pharmaceuticals that really run the gamut. Here's the bottom line from the Associated Press on the study they did. It was, as you mentioned, a five-month investigation involving the AP investigative team. 50 major cities in 50 states were looked at, and drugs were found in the water of 24 major cities. We're talking 41 million Americans here who drink that water. So what's in the water? Everything from acetaminophen and ibuprofen to mood stabilizers, antibiotics, angina, heart, as well as cholesterol drugs, and even sex hormones. The trouble here, Meek, is that the federal government does not test specifically for pharmaceuticals in the water. And in fact, there is no way to scrub water that is in a treatment plant for pharmaceuticals. And so now we have a situation where states and cities across the country are just starting to realize that there are the remnants of pharmaceuticals in the drinking water. All of that said, we should emphasize, we're talking here about parts per billion or trillion, really minute traces of pharmaceuticals that are in the water. And you say, well, how did it get there? Well, without getting too graphic, all of us who take medication for one thing or another, we don't absorb all of it. It is excreted. It gets into the sewage system, into the water treatment plants. And then, because water treatment plants can't scrub it all out, if any of it, it just kind of dilutes on into the water system. Sometimes it gets into the water table, into wildlife, and then into reservoirs. It goes back into the water treatment site, into the water treatment plants.
I wonder if there's going to be, you know, long-term study about effects of this down the road. And but I guess initially, Tom, the question I'm sure you're asking today is there anything the government can do about this?
Yeah, and the EPA says it's concerned about it. But, you know, we don't yet know, and water treatment utility plants say they are convinced that there is no immediate threat to anybody out there. That said, I did a story about 4 years ago in which we found a river in Colorado, and now we know there are many rivers, in which the fish were turning from male to female. And the reason was because there was too much estrogen in the water. The natural female hormone was literally turning...
The key there is, can the government do anything about it? it is a lack of oversight by the EPA being co-opted by special corporate interests that has prevented this from being addressed in the first place. The only way you're going to have clean water is A, to get your own, or B, to filter it. So if you don't have a good water filter, look on the market, get yourself a good one. That's one way you can do it. We're going to close up our program today looking at the issue of empathy.
So what is empathy, and why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think of empathy as this kind of sacred space when someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we look and we say, hey, you can climb down. I know what it's like down here. And you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, uh-huh. No. You want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. And we do it all the time. Because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So I had a miscarriage. Oh, at least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow, and I will be here tomorrow at noon. Have a wonderful day, everyone.
He don't love you like I love you. If he did, he wouldn't break your heart. He don't love you like I love you. He's trying. Some guy that you've been dating. Whoa.